Our world is magical. Games are magical. Open your eyes and prepare to discover how magic and games intersect.
Merry meet and welcome to Covenstead, a podcast about gaming and magic. Covenstead is brought to you by the co-creators of Ironbound, Guardians of Nirvala. Ironbound is a fantasy TTRPG about witches versus machines. Become one of the brave Ironbound and use your magic to defend Nirvala from the mechanized locust-like apothecary.
Hey Danny, do you remember when I was doing the play-by-post of Ironbound and we actually kind of had you patched in as like an advisor, almost like as our setting, you know, slash technical advisor, our Wiccan advisor for our play-by-post game? Do you remember that?
I do.
One of the things that was really great about that was I remember there was one point where one of the players said, you know, well, what if the, you know, like, what if we went to like a cemetery and we met there someplace kind of, you know, like a little off track where no one could see us. And then we started to wonder what would a Wiccan cemetery look like. And what was great was that you were there to just, you know, spit out ideas, because right away, you know, most of us were thinking of gravestones with crosses and other kind of stuff that, you know, clearly would not be part of a Wiccan society. And so I was wondering if I could pick your brain some more, because the in-person game of Ironbound that I'm running, we're starting to really kind of branch out away from like that opening village of Bristlewood. And so I was really starting to wonder what a Wiccan village might look like in Nirvala, like in or in any kind of a fantasy game. If you were to make a Wiccan community in, you know, in like a D&D type setting or something like that, I'd really like to pick your brain on it to give me an idea that I could, you know, that we could take from. Maybe things we haven't really written them down yet, or they're like details we haven't gone into just yet within the written material, because we're still working on the big picture and working our way inwards.
Right. Okay. What aspect would you like me to start with?
Well, if we look at this from a gaming point of view, normally in a role-playing game, we start off with like a tavern, like almost it's the big trope of the fantasy adventure that starts in a tavern, and that's where you actually get your quest. So let's start with that. If every village has its local watering hole where everyone gets together as a common meeting place for meals, for drinks, get-togethers, and that kind of thing, you know, what would be like something that you would envision? Like if you're the GM and you're describing to a party what the inside of a tavern or an inn looks like in a Nirvalan village, what would that be?
Okay. So, I mean, a tavern would definitely have like a lot of the usual things that you would expect, you know, tables, chairs, a bar, you know, a fireplace, you know, music, you know, all of that sort of stuff would definitely be there. I think one thing, so I'll kind of start with the things that might stand out that you wouldn't necessarily expect in a tavern, but I would imagine Nirvalan taverns would have. One, I think, is, and this might be true for other taverns as well, but it would definitely be local stuff that they're serving and stuff that's like in season, you know, rather than coming up with a bunch of stuff that's like complicated. And I think most taverns might do that. You know, they use what's available, but definitely in Nirvalan taverns, that would be true. There would definitely be some sort of, however the tavern keeper or the owner wanted to do it, there would definitely be some protective stuff going on in terms of energy and magic wise in the tavern. Like, you know, maybe they have a bundle of herbs over the doorway of people passing in, you know, of people coming in, or they've put, you know, charms over each of the windows, or you know, some sort of protection. They maybe they painted some symbols on the door. Maybe they have different items they placed on windowsills and stuff like that to protect things going in and out. You know, something like that I think would definitely occur. You might have a kind of altar for sure at these taverns. One, you know, and it would kind of depend on the tavern keeper, but it might be something like they have a altar for family or ancestors to kind of like watch over the business, you know. They might have an altar to just the energy of Novala to like have their business prosper that has maybe statues or items they've left, you know, the first bit of money they ever made or the first exchange they ever made, you know, a remnant of that, you know, something that they can go to kind of put energy into to help their business prosper for sure. A tavern. While they might, there would definitely be shops to gather supplies for magical workings and things like that and other items. The tavern would definitely have something like that too for travelers, you know, along with, you know, the tavern would have stuff like, oh yeah, you can buy food to carry you along the road to go if you want at the tavern. You know, yeah, you can buy a loaf of bread to take with you. Or exchange for a loaf of bread to take with you. They have those things, you know, of course, drink and all that that you can do, or blankets or supplies or whatever somebody traveling might need to purchase. But they might also have things like candles and other herbs and things like that to have available for people to use as well if they need to. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah. I like that touch with the main altar that's kind of like in the common area, but it also got me thinking too of how like the individual rooms could appear in an inn, and the idea of there being an altar space, like a blank altar space for people to use and set up in however way that they want to set up. Kind of like there's always a Gideon's Bible when you go to motels in the real world. The idea of there being a dedicated altar space set up. I like that little touch. That's nice.
For sure.
Yeah. One of the things I like to do when I'm trying to do a different take on something, regardless of the genre, is try and pick like two or three things that are kind of like defaults that you would always assume would always be. So for example, when I think of the food served at a tavern, I always think of Otik's spiced potatoes from the Dragonlance books. That was always my kind of default, and I remember that was something too where people have published recipes for their version of the spiced potatoes and something like that. So that for me is always a trope. So when I think of trying to do something different with a tavern, I try and think of a completely unique way to twist on that kind of stuff. So, for example, I did a fantasy game where there was like a big cauldron that's in the middle on top of a roaring fire. And in it is this constant stew that's always being made. And then people can just kind of come along. You buy the bowl, but you can help yourself to as much of the stew as possible. What would be like two or three things, like kind of default tropes of a fantasy tavern that you would want to change? To give it a more Wiccan tone and feel.
I definitely, this is something, because as you were talking, I had this thought that it would be kind of cool, perhaps, that like, you ever go to those like smoothie places where you can pick like, I want this energy booster powder. Or I want this powder for relaxation, or, you know, you add stuff to it to do certain things.
Yeah, yeah.
That would definitely be cool to have at a Novalan tavern where you can order something, but you can also say like, hey, Can you throw some rosemary in there for luck or something like that? You know what I mean? Like,
It's making me think of when I went to a Vietnamese soup place, or pho as it's called, and you can kind of pick and choose what you want to go in, and you can customize it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, yeah. Yeah, I like that touch. That's
you
nice.
Know, and it wouldn't necessarily be, oh, this is what I want to eat right now, but maybe you're like, I want this, you know, to give myself more energy, a little more pep in my step because I'm tired, you know, like. I want to do this because I'm really stressed out about where I'm going. So I need to relax. So, you know, put this in my coffee or whatever drink I'm having, you know, and stuff like that, that you would have the opportunity to also like kind of add some things to adjust your mood or, you know, give yourself a little bit of luck or prosperity on the road if you wanted to. I think would be something that would be cool and something you don't often see in the taverns and fantasy stuff, really. You know, I can even picture something where if you have a certain type of tavern keeper, somebody comes in and the tavern keeper looks at him and is like, ah, you know, you can use some of this stew to help perk you up. I can see you have like a big cloud over you and stuff like that. Or even you can get into situations where the tavern keeper is suggesting things as well based off what they see, you know.
Could even read their aura to kind of register as just like, oh, you're tired, you're weary, you've been, you know, I can see that you've been walking for days. Here's, you know, something to refresh your energy or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So maybe, hey, how about this? So maybe now that I'm thinking about it, you know, you're saying what would be different rather than, you know, in the typical fantasy and, you know, like, give me a loaf of bread and a tankard of ale and whatever stew you have. Maybe the taverns in Novala don't necessarily have, but like you were saying, it's not just you pick and choose. It would be more like of a build your own sandwich or build your own whatever. So the menu, quote unquote, is not necessarily like dishes, but it's items that you put together to create your own. Nice. And you kind of look at it and you're like, yeah, okay, I'll take some of the deer. I'll take some carrots with that, you know. And you're kind of just looking at the items and the ingredients to kind of put together what you want.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, almost kind of like buffet style, if anything.
Yeah, yeah.
I like that. Yeah, that's different. That's kind of one of those things where it's, you know, buffet restaurants are so common in North America that the idea of applying that into a fantasy setting has never occurred to me before. I like that idea. That's a nice touch.
Yeah, that'd be kind of cool.
So we got that. We've got a nice kind of tavern spot. We've got, you know, something that right away to me, those are little differences to kind of help my players really feel like they're in some place different than like their standard D&D fantasy settings. So now if we branch out from there, so if our players, they now step out of the tavern and the inn and they go out into kind of the main street of this village, of this community, what would be some of like what kind of differences might we see in kind of like architecture or general features of how things, you know, like, for example, one of the things I wondered is if some of the buildings would be a little bit more natural looking, like, for example, the roofs are actually made out of like a mud thatch and a grass and everything like that. I for a while I was picturing something that looked almost kind of like more Scottish, like what you would see in Braveheart kind of stuff, where it looks like these homes and everything were built out of the mud as well as with wood and everything like that. Oh, what kind of architecture might we see?
For sure. That is definitely something that I thought of and would definitely think would be true. They would build their stuff out of whatever was there. So picture like... Perhaps if you lived, depending on kind of what climate or whatever they lived in, it might be wooden houses because they live in a very wooded, they live near a forest, and so they would have houses made out of the wood nearby, shaped and made out of the wood nearby. Or if you have a village that is super in the forest, this would be really cool. Instead of like cutting down trees or anything like that and shaping slats and stuff like that to go along the side. They may do some of that, but they would use the trees as sort of the cornerstones of their house, as like the four structures, like the four pieces that are kind of holding the corners of their house. They would build around the tree, instead of just taking down the trees and building from that. They would like use the branches, and they would use the trunks of the trees to stabilize and cover their houses and their buildings and things.
I like that touch.
I have a picture in my head, and I don't know if it's coming across, but yeah, so something like that. Or if they're near an ocean, for some reason, or a river, they might use river stones, or they might use river mud or something like that. You know what I mean? They would use whatever was around to build their buildings. And it would, I think the main point that I would get and that I would try to do, no matter where the characters were, is that it would fit for where they are and like nowhere else. Whatever it is would look like it belongs there. Like it would look like it's not just these houses that things were cleared out and moved, and there's this village there now. It would look like it's a part of the land. It would look like it's a part of the ecosystem of whatever's happening there, whether that is like an ocean or whether that's the forest or whether that's a mountain, anything like that is what I would say, would be the biggest thing in terms of buildings and how architecture and stuff are formed. I think much like Lothlorien in the Lord of the Rings movies, like and the Shire. How everything was sort of built to what was there. The hobbits have these rolling hills that they use, and so they use the hills as their home. Lothlorien has all these trees, so they build whatever it is that looks like it belongs to the trees.
Nice. It makes me think of out in Prince Edward Island, that I've gone to a couple of times and absolutely adore going out there. It's beautiful countryside. The soil there, it has a very deep reddish tinge to it that it's very noticeable. Like if I all of a sudden fell asleep in a transport truck and woke up 20 hours later and found myself on PEI soil, I would know I was on PEI soil. And that change, and you see it too, even too, like, so if you're building a house, that if you're using the actual mud to kind of, keep things together and everything, you would see that color of the mud. It would be very distinct. Yeah, that's nice. I like that touch. Everything is not built using the materials around them, but it's almost kind of built using the nature as its own infrastructure. So like using the trees exactly as almost as if like if you had to pack up and move, it's like taking down a tent. There would be no sign that you were even there, except there might be like a couple of spike holes in some of the trees where you had to prop something up or something like that. Yeah, nice.
Yeah, for
Okay.
sure. Which makes it all the more striking when the apothecary comes in. You know what I
Yes.
mean? Because it's kind of they're not a part of that. So it just makes it all the more contrasting, when the apothecary come in and aren't doing
Yeah,
that,
they're knocking things down, they're clearing paths. On that note, my son was telling me, 'cause he's very invested of all the different stuff I work on, Ironbound is the one he asked the most questions about, and I think because it shares so much with the Legend of Zelda games, which he adores. But he was telling me that he learned in school that people will use elephants to clear paths through like thick jungles and everything like that, because, you know, the way their head is shaped and with the trunk and everything. And that got me thinking of what like an apothecary machine could look like, that it, as it's trying to clear a path through the forest, that it could actually be shaped to look like an elephant head. That's a little detour. It's a little segue I wanted to mention to you. He's full of great ideas of how to like, you know, use animals to make a new machine with. I have a little list going here every time he comes up with a new idea. So what kind of stalls would there be in a Nivalan village? You know, like what kind? I mean, there's obviously some of the standards. We'd want to have a blacksmith because there still needs to be some metalworking. You know, there would be traders, you know, merchants in a sense, where they, you know, bring wares from one location to another. That's something I've really been incorporating into my versions of Nivala. I make sure that there are traveling merchants always on the road, and they help spread the message of what's going on in other locations and everything. But what kind of stalls, what kind of common wares would somebody find in a Nivalan village?
Well, yeah, among all the basic stuff, I think the more unusual things is there would be a shop for buying supplies that you might need for your home to bless your home. You know, I mean, like we would think of them as like new age shops here, but you would be able to find crystals and herbs and things like that, you know, that have been naturally gathered that you can go and find to use in stuff that you have, you know, at your house and everything. You know, if I need crystals or I need herbs or I need candles or I need anything like that, there would definitely be a place where you can get all those things. As far as, I mean, anything, I mean, that would be one. And I'm trying to think, I mean, this isn't atypical of a town either, but there'd definitely be like books and things like that that you could definitely would have access to. There would be some kind of like bookstore or scroll store or a place where you can find information for sure. There might even be, this would be interesting. There might even be, you know, and it wouldn't be like, I don't want to say like a psychic, and I don't want to say like, what I'm picturing is something between like a psychic and like a rabbi, and like, it's a place where you can go if something is going on, like in your life. Like, let's say, you know, you're having an out with your best friend, you know, you had a fight. And you need guidance on what to do, or you're having trouble getting perspective. There's someone you can go to kind of express the problem, and they can give you advice, like not just magical advice to do this and that, but also, you know, just in general advice about it. There's like a consultant place, you know, where if things are too much, like, you know, like a priest, rabbi,
a mystic figure,
psychic kind of combo. Yeah, that would be somewhere where you can go and do that, you know, bring your problem to, or you know, I'm not quite, you know, or even if you had a question like, oh, I'm not quite sure what I should use for this particular spell, you can go there and they can help guide you and give you advice on what to use. Or I had this dream, right? And I don't know what it means. And I need someone to talk to about it to maybe give me some ideas on what it might mean. You know, like I've told my family and I told my friends, But I need someone not invested in this situation, you know, like someone you can go to for that would definitely be something you could do, you know, or if you're like, I'm about to go on a trip, I need to know, you know, what can I expect or what do I need to know? You can go and get, you know, a card reading or something like that if you wanted to.
Yeah, that sounds very much like, I believe they were called oracles in Viking society, where there was the person of great renown and significance that you would go to for advice, but also to, you know, you wouldn't go hunting until, you know, you would kind of go and get the oracle's blessing or, you know, kind of get like a forecast of portents and stuff like this. Is now a good time to go, you know, like we need to go sailing across, we need to go, you know, fishing or something. And it would be the oracle that would determine when it was time to go. Because they would, you know, read the tea leaves and everything like we've talked about before. It sounds a lot like that. And I like that touch too. And especially too of this person being kind of like the go-to for this kind of thing. Like, yeah, I like that. Well, and it brings up to another question that I wondered about that too, is when it comes to places of worships within these kind of communities, because Wicca is so personal, would there be common places of worship, and what would they look like?
Oh, for sure. Because though Wicca is very individualistic and people have their own altars, they have their own practices and things in their homes. I mean, we also get together, you know, we get together and celebrate holidays. I just did that with Samhain like a little while ago. We got together and we had a big ritual, and then we had a ancestor ceremony where we brought pictures of people who had passed on, because Samhain is also a time to remember people who have passed on and your ancestors. So we had a ritual as a group, and then after that we had food, and then everybody had brought pictures, and we set up a space, a table with a bunch of candles and our pictures. And we sat around and we told stories about the people in the pictures and, you know, expressing and remembering them and stuff like that. So yes, it's individualistic, but at the same time, there are definitely major things that you would do as a village, as a group in Novala, where you would get together for the big holidays and celebrate together. You would get together, you know, before the harvest and celebrate the first, you know, hoping for a good harvest. So there'd be lots of things where the whole village would get together, a wedding or a wedding ceremony, or, you know, presenting a child after they get birth, or, you know, after they're born, you know, anything like that. Villages would get together and do that. And those spaces most likely would be very, very simple. It would be an open clearing or an open space in the middle of the village, you know, circular open space of some kind, either in the middle and it's just like a dirt area, or if they're in a forest, it would be like a clearing in the trees or something like that. And it would have an altar at the northern part of it. And that would be it. And then that's where people would go, and they would set up the altar however they needed to for whatever they were going to do. They might have some permanent features. Like, let's say this village was really, really well known for their apples. Let's say.
Okay.
They might have on the village community space some preserved apples or dried apples all the time, or the dried apples would be made into some kind of decoration that would hang on the altar at all times. So if something was important to the village, or maybe if there was someone important to the village who had passed on, they would have some kind of sketch or rendering or something symbolic of that person in the center area. They might have permanent directional items. Like they might have a permanent, like let's say it's in the clearing, right? They might have on this tree, they might have a permanent symbol of air. On this one, they might have a permanent symbol of fire. You know, maybe the blacksmith had made some iron symbols of the elements. And so they put those up, you know. So they would have a space that would be mostly clear with some kind of altar that they could use. But depending on the village, they might have different things. They might have different things that are permanent in their community space. But the common factor there would be that it was important to the community space to begin with. But, you know, that would be where they would get together for community events and celebrations and mourning and all of that sort of stuff. While people had their personal altars and their personal practices at home.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cool. What would be a way, once again, as a really effective way of personalizing a setting, what would be a way that magic would influence or change something that we would normally consider to be mundane? You know, for example, if we were to see a blacksmith who uses magic, you could see that it looks like they're sprinkling something on the blade before they begin to hammer it. Not like right. a flux, but it's yeah. almost as if like they just pinch their fingers together and then just this, you know, the soft glowing particles just kind of fall upon the blade to bless it or something like that. What would be ways that you would see magic kind of changing something that we might take for granted in a village like this?
I mean, that's a good example. I mean, you would definitely see people, you know, using little blessings along the way during their day, whether they're working or whenever they meet and things like that. You might see offerings in different places as like a thank you or you know, instead of I'm trying to think of how to put this, like, you know, if somebody does something for somebody else, like you know, they do them a favor, they do a good job, you know, there would be an exchange of tokens of appreciation. Okay. You know what yeah. I mean? That would probably be something that would be very common, you know? You know, or someone that had done particularly good work for you for something, you know? Like, for example, that blacksmith, you know, you go to that blacksmith and they make what you asked them for and they did a really good job. So in exchange, you give them, as a thank you, you give them something that you have done. Or whatever. So you would probably see evidence of that in the different places and even the homes of people or outside of the homes where people have left or gifted things to others based on what they have done would be a common practice that you might take for granted in other spaces. Okay. You know? Yeah, I mean, that's one I can think of. But I mean, the big one would definitely be with how ritualistic they might be about some of the things they do, or, you know, adding a little bit of magic or being thankful for whatever resources you're using and things like that, you know. It would be very much a tit for tat kind of society. You know, exchanging things for another to make sure everybody has what they need. You know?
Okay.
So you definitely see evidence of that. You know, you would see evidence of someone, you know, making something for somebody or bringing something to somebody or any of that sort of thing. You would definitely see.
Okay. And it's it makes me think of a way too. It's almost like you could almost kind of see where a person has been in their travels. You know, like let's say you know of an elder from a village, you know, like 2 weeks back. And then you go to a blacksmith and you can see that hanging from his door is basically kind of like a stick doll that this elder makes in particular. And so you can tell that this elder has been here in this village at this point in time. You know, it's, yeah, I like the implication behind it. It's making me think, and I don't want to mention it here because I know my players are, well, they're supposed to be listening to this podcast. Anyway, I don't want to get into any of my plans or machinations or anything on here, but it does make me think that that is a really handy way to be able to kind of follow where someone may or may not have been. Because, yeah, like they always have like these extra special little trinkets and crafts and everything that they make, that they exchange, kind of like the tip jar, you know, if that's what's making me think, if I'm getting this right.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, there's this one person who knits or crochets a bunch of stuff out of material. And so you go into a shop and you see this person wearing a hat in the same style as that person made, you know, like, yeah, you know, it's interconnectedness is what it really is, and showing like how connected we are to each other, you know, and how like we touch everybody's life in some way that we meet, you yeah. know, and it's like physical evidence of that.
Yeah, it's making me think too that that's something I really need to start kind of emphasizing more from my players. I've been making a few notes going back on things where it's like, you know, we haven't really been personalizing their familiars too much. We need to start getting their familiars more involved in the game and everything. And it's making me think too, I think in the next session, I want to start really kind of poking to see what kind of crafts like that their characters might be making. Like, what do they do when they're on watch, you know, and everyone else is, you know, sleeping around the campfire? What kind of things are they working on? Are they whittling something? Are they knitting or any of this other kind of stuff? Yeah, that's a touch I'm going to have to start kind of pushing on. So if the three of you are listening, then you need to start working on making a craft.
Indeed. Yeah.
Nice. I'm trying to think of what else with it. Well, I guess when it comes to, like, you know, governance, like, you know, how these kind of communities would be organized, what would be, you know, would there be anything about a Nivalan community that you would like to see different from how a lot of other fantasy communities are portrayed? Like, we mentioned the idea of there being a mystic, a person of great spiritual importance who is like the consultant to all things big and small. Would there be anything else about how these kind of communities are run and organized that you would change? Like, would you always see there'd always be a council of elders? Or could there still be like a single elder who is voted on by the community and makes all these hard decisions for them and that kind of stuff? How would you like to see them?
I think it can be either or. I mean, it could be a variety of things based on the village. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Maybe the village does have a council of the elders who get together and make decisions. Maybe they do have one person that it kind of makes those decisions and is kind of the leader of the village. Maybe they're extremely democratic, and they just have someone whose job it is to like moderate votes and things, you know. It could be a wide variety of things. I think the main thing to remember is that it would be in some way, yes, you would have a council or maybe someone leading or however it's done. But most of the time, it would also be done with as many members of the village or town or whatever could being able to express their opinions. Like, the people who quote unquote lead would not have absolute power, I don't believe. Like, they wouldn't have the ability to hand down edicts, you know, they would be able to make decisions and all of that, but it would be done with the consideration and the counsel of as many in the village as they could if it was necessary.
Yeah.
You know, many of the you know, small day-to-day decisions, not so much, you know, but if it's anything that's going to greatly affect, then they would definitely have as many of the village as they could. You know, what they would really be would be a moderator and mediator and maybe like an info desk sort of thing. Like, for instance, let's say this village, what they have is a leader, someone who ostensibly is the leader or the one who's moderating the village or the one who kind of makes sure everything is organized, you know, and somebody in the village has a problem. You know, they have a problem where, let's say, their neighbor's animals that they tend to keep getting over into his property, right? And he's tried talking with the neighbor. The neighbor's upset about it too, but they keep trying different things, but they don't work. So what they might do is they might go to the person, the moderating leader, and say, here's our problem. And the leader would be able to say, okay, this is your problem. You know who we should talk to? We should talk to so-and-so because they know a lot about animals and they might be able to tell you why the animals are not staying in your yard. Like think of them like a stage manager almost, right? Like a council or the leader. They're the ones that if something happens, you go to them. And if they don't know the answer or don't feel confident in their expertise, they will send you to someone who does.
Yeah.
Right. You know, but I never thought of them as I never thought of the leaders of Navalan villages as being, here's my creed, you know, go forth and do what I say. You know, it's more like they make sure things are organized and that they direct people to the right places and that whoever needs to know about a situation knows about it. You know, oh, hey, if the animal's getting into your yard, we ought to check with your other guy, this other person who lives down the road and see if the animals are getting that far too. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like they'd be, they're like a stage manager almost. Now that's not to say, I mean, everybody, you can definitely have some kind of plot in a game where this particular village doesn't do things that way for whatever reason. You know, and maybe it's not healthy, you know, and maybe, you know, maybe the players have to do something about that or, whatever, you know, but I mean, so that's not to say you couldn't have one where it's more run like that, but there would be reasons for that in the story. But the vast majority of villages or areas in Nevala would be run in a much more, bottom-up method rather than top-down.
Yeah, more like a co-op apartment building than, you know, what we would consider to be a more traditional town where, well, no, we've elected you, just go take care of it and you let us know if there's any problems. Whereas in a co-op building, right, everyone gets together and has a meeting and certain people are in charge of certain aspects of things, but if anything changes or there's a new thing, it's just like, okay, so I've been put in charge of taking care of the roof garden, but there's like a huge bird dropping problem, we're having a lot of pigeons, so we're gonna need to find a way to clean this up, you know, who can help with that or what should we do, who's got recommendations, and then everyone kind of communicates and pulls their resources together, kind of like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. And you might have a person who is in charge of directing those inquiries, you know, like, they're pooping everywhere. So you'd go to that person and be like, here's my problem. And like, they might know who to talk to, or they'd have the ability to get people together to try to figure out the problem. Like I said, more of an organizational project leader type thing. Yeah. You know, but like problems go from bottom up or issues go from bottom up. They come from the people. They go to the person organizing who then kind of distributes it where it needs to go or directing it, you know, directing the people who need to talk to each other to talk to each other, basically knowing who that's going to be, you know. So that person, if they have such a role, would need to know like who's in the village and what are their abilities and what do they know about, so when the time comes they can be directed to the right person, you know, that they know that that person has that talent, you know. I need some of this herb and I can't find any. This person would know, oh, go talk to this person, because if they don't have it then they will definitely know who will.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
sort of thing.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, cool. You were mentioning, you know, like, you know, that there's ways that this form of governance can go awry. I know for myself, I always want to make sure that nothing is completely rosy, that not everything is written down as, you know, like, the ultimate paradise. Everything is absolutely perfect here and nothing can go wrong except for a rampaging horde of monsters, you know. What are yeah. some of the kind of inherent, I guess, flaws is a way of looking at it, but areas where, for example, it's possible for people like the apothecary to kind of take advantage of. Like, we've talked about the fact that one of the things we wanted to include in Ironbound was this idea that just because the Ironbound are fighting for the Nivalan people doesn't mean that all Nivalans believe that the Ironbound should be fighting for them. You know, that there's room for disagreements right. and everyone having different approaches. And so in doing so, what are some of the things that the apothecary could kind of use to their advantage in how these societies are set up? Like, could it be something where, you know, there's this, like we've talked about, a kind of project manager, and there are various people who are put in charge of things. But if you go to the mystic, for example, can the mystic be kind of like, you know, well, I went to the coordinator, the village coordinator, to say, this is my problem. My sheep are getting into my neighbor's yard. How do I fix this? But then someone can kind of interfere and get the mystic involved, and then the mystic can just basically kind of veto whatever that decision is and kind of override it, is, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there would definitely be, because with a method like that or a system like that, it definitely relies on people buying into it and supporting it, you know. And what if the solution is something that this person doesn't want to give necessarily, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it can create bitterness sometimes, you know. The sheep are getting into my neighbor's yard. It's really annoying. I can't help it. Well, you go to talk to somebody about it, and the expert, you know, says, well, you need this kind of fence and to keep them out. And here's this guy who does that type of fence. So you go over to the guy who does that fence, and you're like, hey, I need this and this, that done. And for whatever reason, maybe he doesn't like you, or maybe he went to the seer and he was cautioned off working for a while because of bad luck or whatever. Who knows? He's made a bunch of decisions that lead him to say no. And so now you still have a problem. And now you're a bit annoyed with this fence person because they're not doing what you need to help. So relying on that many people to get things done means that sometimes those things don't get done because you have to get people to agree to support each other.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's kind of like they're in order to create that kind of cohesive society, there's an inherent form of bureaucracy that can actually complicate things as much as it can solve problems.
Exactly. And people have cross purposes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What if the solution to my problem creates a problem for somebody else? Like, what do you do about that? You know, like,
Well, I was going to say, it gets me thinking to the whole kind of like, you know, if people have these, you know, unique tokens that they give to people as like tips, you know, like as rewards and thanks of appreciation. If you're the village coordinator and you seem to have an awful lot of gifts from this one person and they're very noticeable because they're very distinct, there could be accusations of favoritism and everything else like this and little bits of infighting. That could also start to play, you know, ways where it's like, you know, not everything has to be this completely cohesive whole, that there are still some people in this community who don't quite like each other. There are rumors that are spread about them and, you know, bits of gossip and, you know, and, oh, well, you know, even to like, you know, kind of like generational biases and that kind of thing like that.
Right. Right. Exactly. So, I mean, that's their ideal, is that everybody works together and fills in gaps and does all that stuff. But in reality, they're still people. So that doesn't always happen. That's their goal. That's the idea. That's the thing they are aspiring to. And often, you know, maybe even often it works, right? You know, but there are going to be those points where it doesn't. You know, what if you keeping your animals out of your neighbor's fence creates a problem for someone else somehow? You know, I mean, other than your neighbor, you know, and so your solution to build a fence, right? Maybe that cuts into somebody else's, you know, garden or something when you have to go put it in, you know, like I said, you know, my solution to my problem and what will fix mine may create one for somebody else. And then you're at cross purposes, or you want two different things, which also creates conflict. You know, like, I want this, well, I want this, but mine cancels out yours. So one of us is not going to get what we want.
Yeah.
You know, and there's no, you know, project managing out of that. You know, somebody's going to be unsatisfied. You know, because what I want denies you what you want, you know?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I mean, especially if it comes to maybe a spot or something like that. Like, I find this spot, I want to build my house there. You know, I'm ready to build. I have these materials. I want to do it. I go and want to let everybody know that I want to use this land and stuff like that. And then somebody pipes up and says, no, I want that land because I want to cultivate this plant on this land, you know, and people have their opinions. No, we should let them build their home there. No, we should let this person, you know, raise their plants there, you know? And so the purposes are crossed. They both want that land for different things. And one of them is not going to get it. You know, one of them is not going to be disappointed. One of them is going to have to not be there, or nobody's going to be there, you know?
Yeah. 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 It makes me think, too, there's also room for, you know, superstitions and misinterpretations to become a factor in this. So like that person who wants to build their home in a very particular grove, there could be a superstition about, you know, that a certain area might actually be cursed, or there is the legend that this person once got lost in the woods and this is where they fell, and so this is the home for their spirit. You can't build here because this is where the spirit of the lost widow of the woods resides, and that kind of thing.
Right.
So yeah, mm-hmm. So kind of room for kind of people's individual beliefs and everything to kind of, you know, kind of interfere and get in the way. And then you've got that slippery situation of, it's like, you know, okay, well, no one person is right. So how do we come to the best possible situation, you know, between these completely two differences? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Neat.
For sure. I think we have time for me to talk about one more thing.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, let's do it. Well, I was just going to say, speaking of spirits, here we go. When it comes to how a Nivalan society would handle their dead, like, you know, at the top of this, I mentioned how you helped us kind of figure out what a Nivalan cemetery would look like. What are some of the ways that we would see a Nivalan community when it comes to their ancestors, the deceased and everything like that. You know, would there be something where we would see the markers for where people are buried? You know, like a memorial wall possibly somewhere? Like, what are the kind of, you know, most common things that you think of?
Yeah, the most common I think of, and I think I mentioned this when y'all asked me, was that it's not so much bodies buried there. You know what I mean? It's more like a memorial for these people. Did you ever see Coco?
No, I haven't seen it
yet. The Disney movie? Have you ever heard of like ofrendas? They're basically tables where you put pictures and items from your family, and that's how you remember them.
Okay.
It's you have a picture or items they loved, and it's just this space where you put all of that stuff, almost like an altar. And I picture that there would be a space in the village where that can happen. You know, somebody passes away, and you might have something at your house too, but you want others to know that this person existed and that this person contributed to the community. So you also, on the public area, go and put something there in remembrance of your friend or your brother or whoever it was that passed on. Like in a church, you go in and they have a space where you can light candles for people or prayers or whatever. Stuff like that would be more likely than like a cemetery with tombstones and things like that. It would be more spaces where you can go and remember rather than just a place where like bodies reside. And I know people go to cemeteries and, you know, sit at gravestones and remember and things like that. But I pictured it a lot more lively, you know, a lot more reverential, a lot more about celebrating their life than kind of just going to the place where their body is, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But a lot less somber.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay, okay. Yeah, I know these are, I've been making a few notes as you've been talking, you know, just to kind of, just little differences to kind of make this stand out in a unique way. And especially too, because the crux of the story that we're trying to tell with this particular game is that idea of, you know, of peace-loving people who, you know, live one with nature, and also incorporated into their belief system, into their religion and everything like that. You know, how would we see these things so that we can see what's at risk, you know, how it's been threatened? Like, basically, the reason why we spend so much time in Hobbiton at the beginning of the Lord of the Rings films is that we see what's at risk. And that's, you know, that's one of the things that I really wanted to, you know, start getting across with my group and everything. So, yeah, nice.
Yeah. I certainly hope people get something out of this. I mean, I'm hoping this gave people some ideas, maybe, for things that can be added, and to make the place feel like it should, or grounded in something that's just a little bit different, you know? And so, yeah. So I guess that is it. Let us know what y'all think. You can always communicate with us. And until next time, I hope you have a little gaming in your magic and a little magic in your gaming.
Bye, everybody.
The Covenstead podcast was created and produced by Danielle Delisle and Todd Crapper. Theme music written and composed by John Thompson from the Rook and Rask channel on Twitch. Definitely check them out. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.